This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Okay, try to wrap your head around this little chain for a minute. As the population ages, our doctors are ordering more and more lab tests to screen for disease. So we need more and more labs and lab technicians to perform and read these tests. But here's another population that's getting older. Lab technicians.
Pathologists and clinical chemists, and really, for that matter, medical technologists, are an aging group of people.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about the coming shortage of laboratorians and what's being done to train technicians to take their place. We'll also visit a child care facility that's also a senior center and see what these two groups can offer each other. And we'll spend an academic minute keeping germs in their place in a mobile world. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Like most areas of medicine, the clinical laboratory is seeing a rapid introduction of new technologies in science. New biomarkers for diagnosis and prognosis are being proposed at such a high rate that it's difficult to keep up with the literature. At the same time, the aging population will demand more laboratory medicine services. Now, that said, laboratory directors are themselves an aging population, with some estimates suggesting that up to 50% of current laboratory directors in the U.S. will retire in the next 10 years. Questions have been raised about training the next generation of clinical laboratory directors and pathologists, particularly in respect to how many to train and what areas of the field need to be emphasized. In the March 2012 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry, Dr. Mitch Scott, the co-medical director of clinical chemistry and decentralized testing at Barnes Jewish Hospital and professor of pathology and immunology at Washington University in St. Louis, conducted a question and answer sessions with leaders from around the globe who are training the next generation of laboratory medicine students and physicians. I spoke with Dr. Scott recently and asked about the crop of aging clinical chemists and also asked how this actually became a problem.
Well, the simple answer is that both pathologists and clinical chemists, and really, for that matter, medical technologists, are an aging group of people. Some specific data that I can give you is that in 2005, the median age of pathologists in the College of American Pathologists was 55. Today, it's probably around 57, although I can't quote that like I can in 2005. And in 2005, AACC members had a median age of around 55. So, you know, if it's 55 to 57 today and everyone retires at the age of 65, which of course not everyone will do, but it means that half of the professionals in our field, pathologists and clinical chemists, are going to retire in 10 years. And we're not training nearly enough people to fill that void if that indeed is what happens. Now, how it came to be is actually a pretty interesting story. This goes all the way back to the early 1990s. And President and Hillary Clinton's first attempt at health care reform. Not much came out of that attempt at health care reform from a legal perspective, but it really was the beginning of managed care and attempts to consolidate health care services, including the laboratory. And as part of that movement towards managed care and health care reform in the early 90s, HCFA, the Healthcare Finance Administration, which is now known as CMS, or Center for Medicare Services, commissioned a study to look at all postgraduate training in postgraduate medical education. And one of the conclusions from that study that was published in 1993 was that there were three times more pathologists than needed at that time. And as a result, Medicare, who pays all postgraduate residency slots, had a major cut in the number of funded pathology slots. In 1992, there were like 520 slots, and in 2000, there were only 330 funded slots. At the same time, medical students and graduate students going into fellowships really kind of disappeared. In fact, in 1998, there were only 125 U.S. medical school grads going into pathology, as opposed to about 250 in 1992. At our institution here in St. Louis at Washington University, in 2000, we had 200 applicants for our residency slot. This past year, we had almost 400. It's turned around. But because of the cut in training slots and the cut in interest in going into laboratory medicine in the 90s, has led to the demographics of this being a fairly old field. So what it means is we need to train more people, and it also means that those going into this field today are really in a good position, because combined with the demographics of the field and then the aging population of the country and Western Europe means more tests, more patients, and it's just an ideal time to enter the field. And this is not happening just in the U.S. Dr. Poblani in Italy said that he's having trouble recruiting people into laboratory medicine. And I've used a slide in the past from Australia that's entitled, "It's Pathology Week, but Where Are the Pathologists?" This is not just a U.S. field has gotten old. Hopefully that tells you a little bit about what you asked.
Well, several of the respondents in your piece talk about the explosion of diagnostic testing and how this will make experts in laboratory medicine even more valuable to clinicians and patients as consultants and experts in test selection and interpretation. Now, considering this explosion of knowledge, how do you and other training programs keep up to date?
It's not easy. I mean, you really have to make an effort at it. And I think an approach that we take, and I'm sure many other training programs, both at the residency and fellowship level take, is to have numerous seminars during the week. Most of these are actually given by our residents and fellows, people in training. And we have three or four required seminars a week for our trainees and that are also attended by faculty. And they really accomplish two things. It helps the residents and fellows learn how to give good focused talks, so there's an educational perspective to it. But it also keeps everyone up to date. It's hard to keep up with the literature, and by having residents and fellows and faculty, for that matter, give talks on recent studies, recent findings, it helps to keep everyone going. We also have frequent journal clubs at our resident fellow beeper reports. Whenever an unusual call from the clinician has received, or a disease that some of us on faculty may not have heard of, or a test we may not have heard of, we have the residents and fellows do a 5-minute PowerPoint so that we all learn from it. Another thing that we do is we recruit folks from outside of our laboratory medicine division to give lectures on topics that we believe are going to be important in the future. For instance, I've recruited the director of our core proteomics facility to give a talk on targeted proteomics for biomarkers. We have some next-gen sequencing experts participating, teaching. We hire new faculty. Recently, we've hired several folks in informatics, which are going to be critical in the future of our field. So we've added a molecular diagnostics rotation. You just have to try to keep up.
Well, that sounds well and good, Doctor, but there are only so many minutes in a day. When you add new information to your training, how do you decide what gets deleted from the teaching exercises?
Well, that's a great question, and one that we involved in training here and at other institutions ask ourselves all the time. As you add new topics and add new rotations, such as in molecular diagnostics, to an already busy schedule for residents and fellows, you do need to look at removing some other topics or rotations or shortening them. And the dilemma comes in is what you can hardly stop teaching a clinical chemist basic topics like electrolytes, liver and cardiac and damage markers, or quality control. I mean, these are things that they're going to face every day. So you end up asking yourself, what do you remove from training? One of the things that we do is we try to follow trends in test ordering patterns and new technologies that replace older tests or make them obsolete. So, for instance, our volume of amylase and lipase testing has decreased dramatically over the last 5 to 10 years, and this is really due to improvements in imaging technologies that are now used more often to accurately diagnose pancreatitis, and I've all but removed this topic from my teaching. Another example would be the cardiac enzyme CKMB, which in practice now has been replaced by troponin and potentially newer markers of cardiac risk, and we just don't say too much about it anymore. Another approach is that we have increased the number of topics we cover in our training sessions, but we don't do them as many times per year, so that we may end up having the same number of teaching sessions. We just don't repeat them as frequently during the year. But it's always a challenge to figure out what to drop when you add new material.
Well, all of the respondents stated they believe research to be an important part of training residents and fellows to some extent. How do you feel, and could you define what's meant by research during laboratory medicine training?
Well, I believe that research is an absolutely essential part of training in lab medicine. Whether or not a clinical pathologist or a clinical chemist goes on to have a career with a large component of his time in research or doesn't, I believe that anybody practicing lab medicine worth their salt must read and keep abreast of the literature. And if you haven't participated in research, actually taken a project from conception to publication or answering the initial question or hypothesis, and it really doesn't matter whether it's basic or clinical, but if you haven't done it, I think it's harder to critically evaluate what you read or to be able to recognize a strong study versus a poor study. And if someone practicing lab medicine is going to be good at what they do and be valuable as a consultant, they've got to be able to keep up with the literature and recognize good versus poor studies. Because I often tell our new residents that you just got to get past the if it's published, it must be true syndrome. Let me give you a sports analogy that I can use to say why I believe research is important. Even if you're not going to be doing a lot of research in your ultimate career. A good friend of mine is from South Africa, and he played rugby in his school years, lives in the U.S. today, but he still watches rugby games constantly and knows what he's watching. Now, if I watch a rugby match, I can enjoy the action and the players hitting each other, and I understand the basic rules, how you score a try, but I have no idea what was a good play from a scrum or a bad one, nor do I understand the strategies the teams employ to score a try. It's fun to watch, but I don't quite frankly get it well. And the vice versa could be said for him and coming from South Africa in baseball, but the point is you got to play the game to fully get it. And that's why I believe research during training is just critical.
Well, finally, Doctor, let's look into the future. How will you and others be training residents and fellows in, say, 10 years from now?
I think most everyone in the field believes that there's going to be much more genetic testing, using that genetic testing to target therapies and treatment. And the $1,000 genome is really not that far off. The cost of sequencing the entire genome has been dropping at about the same rate as Moore's Law, and it's going to happen. Exactly what we're going to do with it, I'm not sure is totally clear, but it's going to happen. It will lead to, as I said, targeted treatment, things such as personalized medicine, although I'm not sure I really like that term so much because medicine has always attempted to be personalized. But I like more the targeted, using the result of a lab test to target the therapy. I think now that the proteomic world has moved from sort of random discovery to more targeted discovery, I think we're going to see an increase in proteomic tests in the future. And just beginning to come into the picture are epigenetic markers, things that are beyond sequencing, beyond the proteins that may direct therapy or provide prognosis. I think we're going to see more multi-test algorithms developed using multiple regression analysis. An example that's currently becoming popular are the use of multiple common tests, but putting them through multiple regression to assess liver fibrosis following hepatitis C infection rather than do a biopsy. So a non-invasive test using multiple laboratory tests to avoid invasive procedures. I think things are going to move very rapidly in the next 10 years. And together with the demographic changes, both in the population and in our field, in other words, both the Western civilization population and field of laboratory medicine is getting older, together with new technologies, and all of this in the face of economic pressure to use resources better. It's an ideal time to train people in the field and for young folks to enter the field of lab medicine. I tell our trainees all the time, I wish I was their age, because I think the next 10 to 20 years is going to be quite exciting for laboratory medicine.
Dr. Mitch Scott is the co-medical director of clinical chemistry and decentralized testing at Barnes Jewish Hospital and professor of pathology and immunology at Washington University in St. Louis. You can see his question and answer session in the March 2012 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. You can learn more at aacc.org. still to come, there's a place where the aging population is put together with preschools. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a tape or CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1132. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The Day Services Program at Mount Olivet Church in South Minneapolis is unique in that it combines child care with its senior center to create what administrators call intentional intergenerational interaction. The program serves 35 seniors and 65 children, from infants to preschool. Station KFII producer Will Hale has the story.
This may sound like the usual child care center, with kids playing and having fun. But this is an unusual place. Mount Olivet Day Services combines child care and senior center in the same building to create an opportunity for intergenerational interaction.
I'm Jenny Cullen, and I'm the director of Mount Olivet Adult Day Services in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We are unique in that we have both a child center and an adult center. Our main mission is intentional, intergenerational interaction. So our purpose is to bring people of different ages together, and we found that there are many benefits to both age groups. For the seniors, the adults, seeing the children adds a lot of energy and excitement to their day. Every morning we do some type of intergenerational activity with the children. Monday morning we have a music therapist who comes, and different classrooms come out to our area for a music class. The preschoolers might come another morning for show and tell. The young toddlers might come another morning for an art activity, or the older toddlers come for a game. The infants, they just come. They just act like infants, and they don't have to do anything special. They're just happy to see them, and, you know, sometimes people will hold them.
Patty cake, baker, man. Bake me a cake as fast as you can. Well, let's Patty the market with a bee.
My name is Katie Mikulitz. I am the Director of Child Services at Mount Olivet Day Services. I think one of the big pieces of the job is finding activities that the adults and the children can participate in together.
Games are a popular intergenerational activity. A game as simple as chutes and ladders can be a new experience for both kids and adults.
And then you spin. And then she spins, and then she moves. How many marks that she got on the spinner there? I think.
No, it's your turn.
Yeah, you spin first. You get
no,
the
you
big.
You do it like that.
Okay, how many did she get? Okay, put it on the one. Now count up four. Two, three, four.
Music has a special place in building a bridge across the generations in a way that everyone can understand.
I just love the kids. Oh, we have a lot of fun, and then I read to them, and we talk, and then they come up and ask me if I brought my harmonica, and I said, oh, yeah. So they said, well, will you play some tunes? And I said, sure. And their favorites are usually Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, or You Are My Sunshine. Those seem to be their favorites.
Thank you.
Sharing our lives in an intergenerational experience amplifies the richness of all of our communities. This is Will Hale.
I wish you bluebirds in the spring to give your heart a song to sing and then a kiss. But more than this, I wish you love. And in July, a lemonade to cool you in some leafy glade. I wish you health, but more than wealth. I wish you love.
We love you.
I'm so much older than I'm younger than that now.
Keeping diseases contained to certain parts of the world is getting difficult in an increasingly mobile society. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Throughout history, we've seen pandemics such as the Spanish influenza, bird flu, and SARS move their way across continents. Dr. David Hill, director of global public health at the Frank Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, discusses his research on how to allow people to travel freely while leaving the germs behind.
Each year, nearly 2 billion people are on the move, nearly a third of the world's population. They cross international borders for vacations, study abroad trips, business ventures, or to visit friends and relatives. Or they are moving their home within their own country or to another. Many people move because they have no choice. They are fleeing conflict, famine, flooding, or poverty, and frequently end up in refugee camps where living conditions can be horrific. It is in these conditions that diseases of poor sanitation can rapidly spread, like cholera, which can kill a person within hours if not treated immediately. With so many people on the move, there is a chance of spreading infections from country to country. The best example was the spread of pandemic or swine influenza in 2009. This flu virus crossed the globe in less than 6 weeks. There are other less well-known examples, such as tuberculosis, typhoid fever, and malaria. While many of these may not spread easily, people who have them still need to be identified and treated. How can we deal with germs on the move? The options are many, but world health leaders agree that providing primary medical care for newly arrived migrants is important to detect infections and to treat them cost-effectively. There also have to be excellent methods to identify outbreaks of disease that may be a public health threat and to develop the capacity to respond to and manage them. It will then be more likely that we will have healthy people on the move rather than their germs.
That was Quinnipiac University's Dr. David Hill. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.